Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For nearly 30 years, Michael Sandel has taught one of Harvard's most popular courses. Each year, more than 1,200 students cram into the university's largest lecture theater to learn about moral and political philosophy. In a new book and public television series based on the course, Sandel challenges us to consider what's the right thing to do about the most controversial dilemmas facing society today. The title of his new book is Justice. Political philosopher and author Michael Sandel joins me in this studio. We welcome your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Don't forget you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Diane. It's great to be here.
I'm looking at the title of this book, Justice.
Yes.
And then beneath it, the subtitle, What's the Right Thing to Do? Somehow, the two don't always go together.
Well, that in itself is a philosophical question of real interest that you've raised. They don't always go together. The right thing to do is something that we confront all the time in our personal lives,
right,
as well as in politics. Justice has a place, I think, in some aspects of our personal lives, but it seems to come up to fit more naturally with politics, with political arguments. So I suppose you could say that justice and questions of rights and fairness and the common good, these are questions of moral philosophy that have special relevance for politics and for political debate. How to distribute the good things in life, income and wealth, power and opportunities, honor and recognition. This is the stuff of debates about justice.
Mm.
And while philosophers, ancient and modern, wrote about this subject, what strikes me and what I try to bring across in the book is these are questions that are just beneath the surface of all of the debates we have in politics, including some of the most fiercely contested ones.
And yet there is such cynicism abroad.
Yes.
That the public rarely thinks of the right thing to do when it comes to some of the decisions that politicians make. In other words, there are times when politicians make decisions because their political parties want them to make that decision, not because it's the right thing to do.
Fair enough, and it's certainly true. Politics is certainly about the play and competition of interests, interest groups, self-interests, the desire of politicians to be reelected. So power and interests are right at the center of politics and have always been. But that doesn't mean that politics isn't also always about questions of values, including justice and rights and the meaning of citizenship and the claims of the common good. Every time we hear a political argument, we can analyze it from both points of view. We can say, actually, what is this politician, how is he or she trying to position himself or herself on the issue? And who are the special interests behind that position? So we can analyze it from that point of view, and we do that often. Most of the media coverage is about that aspect, the interest, the power, the constituency questions. But we can also analyze that argument from the standpoint of its substance. Is this a plausible case for or against health care? To take one example that we're arguing about today. And what I've tried to do is to show how the arguments we have, whether about bailouts or health care or torture or affirmative action or same-sex marriage or abortion, these are fraught political questions that do involve power and interests, no question about it. But they also involve big questions about values, about ethics, about individual rights and the common good. And what I'm trying in some small way to help us do is to have that aspect of our political argument loom larger in our public debate.
I'm so interested that in the mid-70s, you went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar to study economics. Now, how did that avenue bring you to where you are now?
Diane, I was always a political junkie from the time I was a kid. And when I went to college, I was interested in studying politics, political parties, that sort of thing, and economics and history, concrete things. And I tried taking a course in political philosophy, I think as a freshman. And I read these books by famous philosophers like Plato and Aristotle and John Locke and Immanuel Kant. I really couldn't make much sense of it. I found it abstract, distant, and daunting. So I set it aside and I devoted myself to questions, more concrete things. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I finished college, what I would be when I would grow up. I thought maybe a political journalist or a lawyer, or maybe, I thought, maybe even run for office. And I had the chance to go to Oxford and to delay this decision. And I thought, well, I'll spend a term reading the history of political thought just to get that under my belt, and then I'll get back to more concrete things, economics, politics, and so on. Well, that term, it took a little longer for me to wrap my mind around the history of political philosophy than one term. And I became hooked by it. And I wound up writing my dissertation in political philosophy and getting my degree in it and teaching. And I haven't really managed to disentangle myself since. So that's really how it happened.
The whole question you've already raised of health care, something about which this country is sort of on the side, watching as politicians debate what's going to happen. We as a people have felt somewhat pushed aside in this debate, while you've got very, very strong lobbies on the Hill influencing various politicians. So the public seeing this becomes more and more cynical that what the Congress is going to end up doing is the right thing to do. How do you sort of dissect what's happening and how we might view and indeed enter this debate?
Yes. Well, it's certainly true that powerful lobbies hold great sway in the healthcare debate. But I think one of the interesting things about the whole healthcare debate is that from the standpoint of President Obama's leadership, his ability to articulate the moral issues at stake in the healthcare debate, I think will largely decide, how well he can do that will largely decide the fate of healthcare. Over the summer, he began to lose control of the healthcare debate. I think one of the reasons that happened, and we had all the town hall meetings and people were angry and so on, I think one of the reasons that happened is that he was framing the healthcare debate too much in terms of costs, I heard him on C-SPAN at a town hall meeting saying we have to bend the cost curve in the out years. And I thought, oh, my gosh.
What does that mean?
He's not going to really persuade the public to rally around a serious health care proposal if he goes on talking that way about it in almost technocratic terms. And then when he gave the speech to the joint session of Congress on health care, in the last 10 minutes, he began by the last passage, reading that letter from Senator Kennedy. Now, Senator Kennedy had always talked about health care in moral terms, remember, as a right, not a privilege. And he read that passage from Senator Kennedy, and then in the last 10 minutes of his speech, he, President Obama, returned to the moral high ground that had so inspired people during the campaign. And he addressed the moral issues at stake, and he acknowledged the force of the argument, the underlying argument of principle by those who disagree with the government role mandating that everyone have health care or contribute to the health care of those who can't afford it. He said there is an individualist free market position. And then he responded and explained why he rejected the purely individualist laissez-faire view of markets and government for health. And he argued that the American character included a sense of solidarity and obligation to one's fellow citizens in the name of the common good to see to it that no one is devastated because they happen to fall ill. And then I think he reconnected. He reconnected with the moral argument, and that, I think, is the way to break through the interests and the lobbyists.
Harvard professor Michael Sandel, his new book is titled Justice. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Harvard University professor Michael Sandel is with me. He's written a brand new book. It's titled Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? The book is accompanying a new PBS series that will begin when, Professor Sandel?
It's just begun showing in some places around the country. I think in the Washington area, it's beginning early November.
Early November. We'll look forward to that. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Let's talk about capitalism and the so-called free market philosophy. Michael Moore, as you know, has just sent this film of his all over the country. Some people have ridiculed him. Some people have called him a hero. The whole question about is free market capitalism fair to everyone in the society? How do you approach the question?
Well, the strongest argument for free markets is the argument that it's a way of organizing productive activity efficiently, with the result being that a greater economic bounty and prosperity is produced than would otherwise be the case. Now, how does this connect with considerations of justice? Well, there is one view of justice, the utilitarian view, that says, seek the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. And if you accept the utilitarian philosophy, you will think that more economic prosperity, more economic growth is a good thing because it makes people happy. It gives people what they want. The problem arises when the distribution of the bounties of markets and of a capitalist system wind up being highly unequal. And so then another question arises for justice that the utilitarian philosophy may not be able to answer all that well, and that is, who deserves what? Is it fair that there be vast inequalities between rich and poor? And so questions about the distribution of income and wealth loom very large, and different theories of justice approach them in a different way. But one thing is clear. Simply because a certain distribution of income and wealth was produced by market relations, even a free market, does not mean necessarily that that distribution is fair, because that's a question of justice. And markets do not sanctify or bless the distributions they yield as being just. That's something we have to debate as citizens. What is a fair distribution of income and wealth?
Do you think that's being debated?
It isn't being debated much. Can I give you one very concrete example,
please,
that illustrates why the results of markets are not necessarily fair? Let's take the salaries people make. Chief Justice John Roberts, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, makes what? A little over $200,000 a year. That's a good salary. There's another judge who makes more than Chief Justice Roberts. Do you know whom I'm thinking of?
Judge Judy.
Judge Judy.
Yeah.
She makes $25 million a year. Now, from the standpoint of markets and supply and demand, apparently Judge Judy is able to supply something that is in great demand. I'm not sure what it is, but in any case, from the standpoint of justice, does anybody really think that simply because the market produced this result, that Judge Judy deserves to make 100 times as much as the Chief Justice of the United States? So it's a vivid way of reminding ourselves that the distributions that markets yield are not necessarily just or fair. It's a moral and political question what counts as a fair distribution.
President Carter once said, life's not fair. Therefore, a good many people listening to that comparison contrast you've just made is that it's not fair to think of the Supreme Court justice and an entertainer,
right,
in quite the same way. Fairness perhaps is not the right way to judge. It's the demand on the part of the public. The athletes, same way.
Right.
Millions and millions of dollars, and yet civil servants, teachers, people who drive buses, who continue to keep our country safe, soldiers, are paid minimum amounts. Where is the fairness?
Well, insofar as we do argue politically about the fairness of the distributions that markets produce, usually it takes the form of saying, we should have a progressive tax system so that those who are fortunate to have the skills that society rewards lavishly, those people have a responsibility to pay a larger share of what they make in taxes than other people in order to provide for essential public services, for education, for the health and welfare of everybody, So the progressive tax system and just how progressive it should be is one way that we grapple with this question. And more recently, we've been hearing a lot about executive compensation and bonuses. And now Mr. Feinberg has been charged with the task of looking at reviewing the CEO compensation for the companies that have received funds from the bailout. Now, it's interesting. I'm not sure exactly what he's going to look for. I'm not sure he's looking for the justice of the compensation level. I think he's more concerned with adjusting the incentives about risk-taking and compensation. But we do have these debates, mainly in designing the tax system and the social safety net that is supported by a tax system. And we could go much further. Most European countries go further in the direction of progressive taxation to support health and education and welfare and public transportation than we do. And the fact that we have done less than the European countries may suggest that we have a less strong tradition of social solidarity, and we lean more in an individualist, market-oriented direction.
You talked about utilitarianism earlier. Doesn't that lead one to believe that torture is just fine?
Well, the strongest arguments that we've heard in defense of torture are utilitarian arguments. When former Vice President Cheney has been going around defending torture, he has said there are hundreds, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of lives at stake in finding out and by torture, if need be, how to prevent another 9/11. That is a utilitarian argument. Numbers count. That's the utilitarian idea. But I think there's a defect in that argument. Even the ticking time bomb scenario, which imagines a bomb, a nuclear device buried hidden in Manhattan, about to explode, and the only way you can find it, according to the philosopher's hypothetical, is to torture the suspect. A lot of the moral force behind the ticking time bomb scenario, or for that matter, former Vice President Cheney's argument for torture, is not only that numbers count. There's an implicit further assumption, which is a non-utilitarian idea. Those examples have intuitive plausibility because we're assuming that that person being tortured is either the terrorist or a really bad person who deserves pretty rough treatment anyhow. In fact, some people would support torture on that ground alone, even if there were no ticking time bomb. But we can separate out those two considerations, numbers, and this guy is bad and deserves punishment, by imagining another version of the ticking time bomb scenario. Suppose the only way you could get the information was not to torture the terrorist suspect, but to torture his innocent 12-year-old daughter. The intuitive moral force would be much weaker. And that suggests that the utilitarian idea that numbers are decisive for morality in the torture case is not the whole story. Justice is also about giving people what they deserve. And surely that the daughter does not deserve this kind of treatment, which I think is why a great many people may be tempted by the first case would hesitate powerfully in the second.
Michael Sandel is professor at Harvard University. He teaches a course which is probably one of the most popular at Harvard University on political philosophy. And you can join us. We'll open the phone shortly, 800-433-8850. There was a great deal of hope and civic strength during the election.
Yes.
And watching now President Obama deliver his very enthusiastic, emphatic speeches about idealism, civic behavior, and contribution seem to light up people who listen to him. Do you think something has happened to his delivery, to his thinking, to his behavior that has changed political discourse since his election?
You mean for the better, or that it's been less stirring?
Whatever you think.
I think there has been a subtle change that is not irreversible. I have a view about what it was that was so inspiring about candidate Obama. Of course, he's a wonderfully capable and gifted speaker, but I think it's not only that. I think that he, for the first time in a generation, connected progressive ideals with a larger moral and spiritual way of talking about politics. For a generation, going back to the 1980s, conservatives, cultural conservatives and the religious right, had almost a monopoly on the moral and spiritual dimensions of political argument. And liberals and progressives in recent years, for the most part, were almost allergic to bringing moral and spiritual questions into politics for fear that this would lead to intolerance and coercion. And so liberals shied away from that. It wasn't always that way. Martin Luther King drew explicitly on moral and sometimes his own Christian faith in arguing against segregation and for civil rights. Robert Kennedy drew explicitly on moral and spiritual and a kind of civic idealism. But from the time of Ronald Reagan to the time really of Barack Obama, I think there was that shift. I think part of what was so inspiring about Obama is that he brought moral and spiritual questions back into a progressive political vision. Since he's been president, in part because he's been swamped with trying to deal with economic recovery, to say nothing of questions of war and strategy and so on, the bailouts, I think that voice has been muted. And what struck me, I mentioned earlier, the last passage of his speech on health care before the State of the Union, is that we heard again what so stirred the country during the campaign, connecting political questions, policy questions, in this case about health care, to a larger moral framework. I think that's his great strength and the great hope, for that matter, of his presidency.
At 25 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And right now, as we speak, the debate over Afghanistan and the U.S. position vis-a-vis sending more troops, staying the course, pulling troops down, is being both politically and morally debated. How do you see the president dealing with that issue?
Very deliberately, and rightly so. Most of the greatest part of the debate and the decision about what to do in Afghanistan has to do with, I think, practical political judgments about the priority. And President Obama has said the priority is trying to root out al-Qaeda, not necessarily shoring up the regime. Those are practical political judgments. The moral questions come in when we begin to ask the question, is the mission worth the moral price in the lives lost and sacrificed of American troops and of civilians in Afghanistan? So the moral question clearly comes into it, and there's a long tradition of debate about just and unjust war and what loss of life is justified by what ends. But a lot of the debate about Afghanistan is, rightly about the hard, practical, political judgment about what we should aim at, and then, of course, what price we're willing to pay for it. And that does get back to the moral question.
And the moral question, do you believe that the moral question, you said the political question is really the larger question
yes.
being debated, but how do the political and the moral questions get dealt with fairly?
Well, in the case of war and peace, a president has to feel, and I think most presidents of all political stripes feel, the moral burden of sending American troops into harm's way. And also, I hope they feel, and most do, the moral burden of the civilian casualties. They have to be weighed against the ends and against the mission.
The book is titled Justice.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon, author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and the Yiddish Policeman's Union, talks about being a father and a husband. His new collection of personal essays is called Manhood for Amateurs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to our conversation with Harvard University Professor Michael Sandel. His new book, accompanied by a television series, is titled Justice. Here's an email from Grant, who says emphatically, Professor Sandel, you cannot compare the Chief Justice with Judge Judy, because the Chief Justice is not part of a capitalist system. The government determines his pay, not the markets. Bad comparison.
I'm not sure it's a bad comparison. I agree that the government sets the pay of the Chief Justice, and local school districts set the pay of school teachers. But the fact that we pay school teachers what we do, and that sports stars and Judge Judy and entertainers make what they do, does reflect on our values as a society. And now, those values are reflected in different ways, sometimes through government action or the decisions local school boards make or the tax rates that are set that enable us to pay Supreme Court justices and school teachers. And sometimes those values are reflected by what we as consumers want or even thrill to in the case of sports stars and entertainers. But our values as a society are reflected in both what government does and in the rewards that markets bestow.
Here is another one following up on that point from Mike in Jacksonville. He says, athletes and entertainers get paid what they do because they can do things that we cannot, and there is a large demand for their talents. We, the people, create that demand. You automatically turn capitalistic people off by speaking of fairness. It sounds weak and pitiful. Most people have the ability, but not the gumption, to create themselves into what they want to be. Now, if there is something that's unfair, it's the CEOs making multi-million dollar bonuses after their companies have laid off workers, lost money, and maybe even received a bailout.
Right. Okay, well, there is a general issue here. And it raises, Mike has raised, and in a way Grant did too, a big question about principle. If you look at what great sports stars or entertainers make, take what A-Rod makes for the Yankees. You know, this he makes, what, $30 million a year, something like that. It's true. It's not just that he works harder than you or me, Mike. He's gifted. And the society has a great taste for what he does. And those in a way, are morally arbitrary facts. It's not his doing that he happens to live in a society that prizes what he can do and that relatively few people can do as well. So unless you believe somehow that it's all the doing of the entertainer or the sports star or the CEO, then I think you should be prepared to enter into an argument about how we should distribute or redistribute the fruits of that activity. May I say something about the CEO compensation,
please,
Diane? There, too, the enormous CEO salaries and bonus packages, I think, raise a question of justice, not only in times like this one, where the government is subsidizing the companies and therefore the bonuses. That's egregious and outrageous. But there's a broader issue. Are those salaries and compensation packages justified in good times when the government is not, at least not directly, subsidizing them? The CEO, do you have some, what would you guess is the ratio between what CEOs make and what average workers make?
Oh, my goodness. It's got to be about 3,000 times.
Well, it's in the hundreds. It's
okay,
300 to 400.
Okay.
Yeah, 300 to 400.
All right.
But it's huge disparity.
It's
up there. That's today. It's about 345 times. Back in 1980, which is not all that long ago, the ratio was 42. Now, do we really...
42 times.
Times.
What the worker makes.
What the worker makes.
The CEO made.
Right, whereas now it's 345, roughly. Now, do we really think that today CEOs work 8 times as hard as they worked back in 1980? Or that today they are 8 times more talented than they were back in 1980? No, of course not. The changes in compensation have to do with factors that are not the doing of the people who hold the jobs. And
what are they due to?
Well, they're due to changes in the economy. They're due to changes. They're due to outsourcing. They're due in part to globalization. They're due in large part to the way the capitalist system has become global. And that's, in relative terms, depressed the salaries of workers. But What it brings out is there's nothing sacred or connected to moral desert or their own effort that can account for these huge disparities in compensation. And this is a point that doesn't only depend on the fact that the government happens now to be subsidizing them.
Let's go now to Ocala, Florida. Good morning, Travis. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. My question, I know you've gathered a lot of experience in and you have a wealth of information. But it's actually to inspire myself and other younger viewers, and even older viewers that are listening. When you send out the graduates, let's say that they are taking their last course and your last chance to make an impact on them, what do you reserve for your last statements to them to send them out to hopefully go and make the changes in the world needed to be?
Well, that's a great question. May I give you a concrete example of something that I offer them?
Yeah,
it's not something I preach to them, Travis, but it's a question that I put to them. And it's related to this last part of the discussion about whether we really morally deserve and earn all the good things and the good fortune that we have. We've been talking about CEO pay. The students in my class at Harvard feel very fortunate and privileged to be there. And they've worked hard, as all students work very hard, many students work very hard in high school to get into college and university. But I want them to question the idea that it is all their own doing. I want them to question the idea that our good fortune is a matter, is something that we deserve. And so I ask, how many here are first in birth order? Because, you know, psychologists say that the oldest child often has the strongest work ethic, drives, and so on. About 75 or 80% of the hands go up.
Really?
Now, that's not preaching to them, Travis, but it is a way of inviting them to reflect on the fact that the good fortune that may take many forms for many of us may not be all our doing, and maybe we shouldn't inhale too deeply of the sense that we deserve everything we get. And that creates room to reflect on what we may owe other people, including those less fortunate than ourselves.
I'm glad you called, Travis. Where in your own mind, Professor Sandel, might faith enter into your own thinking and how you approach the idea of justice?
Part of the thrust of my book, I don't talk about my own faith tradition, which is Jewish, but I do talk a lot about the role of faith as it informs political argument. And there is a real difference among philosophers about this. There are some philosophers who say that the reasons we bring to bear when we argue about politics, whether civil rights or health care or abortion or stem cell research or same-sex marriage, the reasons should not refer to faith or to religion, because we disagree about faith and religion. And so how can we have a society based on mutual respect if we bring that in? It's a recipe for intolerance. I disagree with that view. I argue in the book for a more faith-friendly kind of public discourse, very much in the way that President Obama, as we were discussing before, argued that moral and spiritual and even faith-informed views should be a part, he argued, of progressive politics. If you think back to the abolitionist movement in the 1830s and 40s, we forget that the most powerful abolitionists, many of them were evangelical Christians who argued that slavery was a sin. So I'm not among those who say we should try to keep faith and views informed by faith out of politics. I think we should welcome all comers. That doesn't mean we're going to agree. But politics is never about agreement. I think we can enrich our public debate and our public arguments by engaging more directly with moral and spiritual questions, including ones that may be informed by faith. And I would say that not only when we're talking about the economy and social justice, but also when we're talking about the so-called cultural issues like same-sex marriage and abortion and stem cell research.
Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. Good morning, Tariq. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Morning, sir.
I have a twofold question. The first question is, I'd like to know your guest best definition of the term justice? And my second question is, what does he think of the question of reparations for the descendants of slaves here in America in light of his definition of justice?
All right, sir. Thanks for your call.
Great. I'll give you a short definition of justice, Tarek. Giving people what they deserve. Now, you may find that a disappointing definition because the real controversies begin when people have different views about who deserves what and why. The reparations question is actually one that I discuss in the book, and I discuss it in the context of considering individualistic approaches to justice that say, I cannot in principle even be responsible for something that was done a generation or three or four or five generations ago. When Congress debated in an earlier time, debated the reparations question, Henry Hyde made this principled argument. He said, I never owned any slaves. Why should I be held responsible for injustices that were committed many generations ago? This raises a big question about how we think about justice. Is moral responsibility something that has a collective character to it? Mm. Can it extend across generations and impose moral burdens on successor generations who were not themselves implicated in the injustice? Or is moral responsibility so individualistic a thing that we can't even make sense of that? And the answer I give, Tarek, in the book is that I think the individualistic idea lying behind Henry Hyde's observation is mistaken, is wrongheaded, because if you believe that, it's very hard to make sense of solidarity, the obligations we have as members of a political community to seek the common good for everyone, very hard to make sense, for that matter, of patriotism. What is it? How can we in this generation take pride in our history if at the same time we are not prepared to take responsibility for the injustices that are part of that history? So solidarity and a kind of collective responsibility, I think, are part of justice.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To follow that, would you be in favor of reparations for the descendants of slaves?
Well, in principle, I think we should have that discussion. I think there are practical questions about what form any reparations should take. There has been much recently in the way of collective apologies, official apologies, some enacted by Congress and also by parliaments and presidents of and prime ministers of other countries. In the case of Australia, a formal apology for the injustice done to Aboriginal people. In the United States, a formal apology to those who were interned, the Japanese Americans interned during World War II. So I see no reason why America should not come to grips more fully with the legacy of slavery. Now, sometimes reparations are thought to imply individual payments to the descendants of slaves. I'm not sure individual payments are the best expression. That's why I hesitate to give a simple policy answer here. But I do think if we conceive this question as a matter of collective responsibility of a people with a history, that it's perfectly reasonable for us to figure out the appropriate way of giving expression to that injustice and its legacy.
In the 1 minute we have left, I'd like to hear what you would say to President Obama about justice.
I would say, Mr. President, you should follow your instincts, the instincts that served you so well during the campaign, when you stirred this country by connecting politics and policy with big questions of a moral and spiritual kind. And don't let, Mr. President, don't let the pressures of office or of the financial crisis distract you from that fundamental strength, and you will help make us a better, more morally engaged democracy if you can recall and recover that promise of your presidency.
Michael Sandel. He is professor of government at Harvard University. His new book is titled Justice: What's the Right Thing to Do? Thank you so much for being here. So wonderful to hear you.
Thanks so much, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.